Morning. It's 11 minutes before 8 a.m. This is Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka. Today is Tuesday, March 4th, 2014. I'm Melissa Marconi-Wenzel with Raven News. The Sitka Fine Arts Camp has broken the $2 million mark in annual revenues. Director Roger Schmidt told the Sitka Chamber of Commerce last week that business at the camp had grown by a factor of 32 since he was named to the post in 2000. The budget that year, Schmidt said, was $70,000. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has more details.
Schmidt compared the growth of the arts in Sitka to places like Chautauqua, New York, Banff, Alberta, and Aspen, Colorado. Banff is a town only a little bit larger than Sitka, but has an arts program that generates tens of millions of dollars in annual revenue. In Aspen, Schmidt said, the arts produce more income than skiing. Schmidt suggested that it was time Sitka began to see itself the way others do.
We're a long ways away from being an Aspen or a Banff, and we may never be an Aspen or a Banff or a Chautauqua, but I guess I'd really like to present that to Sitka, that it's a powerful resource that can be leveraged over and over and over again if we take that route to think about how to make Sitka the most attractive place for talent to be raised, for talent to be retained, and for talent to be attracted to, the most attractive community for visitors to come and spend time here, and more time and longer time, and for them to figure out ways for their families to make Sitka more and more of a destination.
Schmidt said the camp achieved an unprecedented level of stability when it received the core Sheldon Jackson campus in 2011 from the defunct college's Board of Trustees. Not having a reliable home inhibited growth. But the campus also came with some major liabilities. It had been boarded up for nearly 4 years. Schmidt said he took pains to avoid the campus.
I didn't go up Jeff Davis Street anymore unless I had to. It just depressed me at a very deep level.
Now, Schmidt said, 46% of his budget is spent on capital improvements. He said the work would literally never end.
I think we're at the worst moment in sort of historical battle that one can be at. But I think that any, you know, large 100-plus-year-old campus is just a constant capital project. I think that 3 years ago when we started, it was in so many ways impossible to use. I think one of the things that we've worked on is trying to make more spaces non-seasonal. You know, the first year of camp, we literally had no heat anywhere on campus.
Having a heated permanent home has allowed the camp to expand programs. Schmidt said the camp now enrolls 1,000 students from 38 Alaskan communities, 27 states, and 5 countries, but tuition accounts for only 23% of the camp's revenue. He stressed that contributions remain a major factor in the camp's success, contributions which can be leveraged time and time again into matching grant funding. Schmidt described the camp as a component of Sitka's visitor industry, one which cultivated very deep ties to the community, really deep ties.
And we have so many multi-generational families that come to the camp, whether they're teachers or whether they're grandchildren or whether they're children, people getting married at camp. Not married at camp. Married because they met at camp. They do the preliminary work. No.
And the work of restoring the campus, that is, goes on. Schmidt said over 700 community members have logged 30,000 volunteer hours helping prepare the campus for the arrival of students each summer. And all those sheets of plywood that boarded over campus windows?
We've used them for theater sets, and we've used them to drive our tractors on the lawn and not mark the lawns. We've used them for subfloors and rotten floors. And so all that plywood's gone to good use.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
There are volunteer work parties every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. at the Sitka Fine Arts Camp from now until camp opens in mid-June. Hot lunch is provided. For more information about camp programs and enrollment, visit our website, kcaw.org. State officials want the federal government to remove some protections for southeast and south-central humpback whales. But a noted researcher says it's too early to do that. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Whalers killed so many humpbacks in the 19th and 20th centuries that many worried they might become extinct. Harvests ended in the mid-1960s when an international treaty took effect. Then populations began to grow as governments adopted protective policies.
This is a success story. This is one species that no longer needs the protection of the Endangered Species Act, and we should celebrate that.
Doug Vincent Lang is director of the state's Division of Wildlife Conservation. He says humpbacks will stay safe even if they lose the act's protections.
Even if you delisted the species at the end of the day, they'd still be adequately protected under existing whaling agreements and existing Marine Mammal Protection Act regulations.
He says humpbacks are numerous in waters from Cook Inlet to southern southeast, the population the state wants delisted. The whales still die of disease in old age when hit by ships or tangled in fishing gear. But he says rapid population growth, which the state estimates at 7%, means there are plenty to replace them. University of Alaska marine biologist Jan Straley says it's not that easy.
Just to say you're going to delist the central stock is almost a simplistic way of saying these whales are one big group, but really, in essence, when they come to Alaska, they aren't.
Straley says breaking up Alaska humpbacks into eastern or western populations does not reflect their full life cycle. Most southeast whales winter in Hawaiian waters, though some swim to Mexico. But when they return in the summer, they split up and head to specific parts of the coast. As that cycle repeats, they develop hereditary differences.
You could basically wipe out a whole genetic lineage of whales if something happened catastrophically. I'm not saying that that's going to happen, but, you know, it's a risk of kind of ignoring that part of the structure of the population.
She agrees humpback numbers have grown, but she says the most frequently used estimate is based on old research, so there's no way of knowing for sure what's happening now. The petition to remove the whales from Endangered Species Act listings was submitted to the National Marine Fisheries Service, also called NOAA Fisheries. That agency has 90 days to decide whether it's worth considering the petition. If it does, spokeswoman Julie Spiegel says a full review will take about a year.
We look at factors that may cause the population to have difficulty in the future, like ocean acidification, lack of food, that type thing.
Studies suggest a more acidic ocean could hurt krill, small shrimp-like organisms humpbacks eat. If the petition is approved, the population will continue to be covered by the Federal Marine Mammals Protection Act. That prohibits hunting, requires habitat protections, and sets a safe distance for whale-watching tours. So what more does the Species Act do? NOAA Fisheries' John Kerlin says it reviews any federally funded work that could affect the whales.
We do consultations on things as simple as coastal construction projects, revamping a port or harbor, driving piles for a wharf, to broader scale activities like seismic exploration for oil and gas.
The Hawaii Fishermen's Alliance, which works where whales spend the winter, filed its own humpback delisting petition last April. That's going through the review process now. NOAA Fisheries Spiegel says it covers all North Pacific humpbacks, a larger population.
The central North Pacific stock, which the state of Alaska is now petitioning us to designate as a distinct population segment, would be a subcategory of that. So we'll have to look, do some checking internally here and see how these two petitions dovetail.
Alaska officials are looking at other marine mammals they think no longer need Endangered Species Act listings. Wildlife Conservation's Doug Vincent Lang says bowhead whales are a possibility. So is the western population of Steller sea lions.
That population is currently listed as endangered, but there's 75 to 80,000 of those animals now, and we think at least the downlisting to threaten this may be appropriate at this point in time, if not a complete delisting.
Removing a marine mammal population from Endangered Species Act protections is not unheard of. NOAA Fisheries pulled eastern North Pacific gray whales off the list 20 years ago, and last year it delisted eastern Steller sea lions, which live in southeast. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
You can read the state's petition to delist the whales through a link posted on our website. You can also read an earlier report on humpback population growth. A measure setting up an Alaska Transportation Infrastructure Fund has gotten some traction in the House, but two companion bills are not seeing the same attention. The resolution seeks to amend Alaska's constitution to create a fund that would pay for airport, highway, and similar projects. If the measure passes the legislature, it would go before voters in the November general election. Wrangell Republican Representative Peggy Wilson is the main sponsor.
We're putting more and more people on roads that were designed for the 70s. Our ferries are old and well maintained, but the older ferries cost a lot to maintain, and they're coming to the end of their projected life expectancy.
Wilson's measure and two related bills call for setting up a $2 billion account. Continued funding would come from fuel taxes, license fees, and similar payments. The constitutional amendment passed out of the House Finance Committee on Friday. The two bills, which set up and put money in the fund, were before the committee earlier this month. They have not been scheduled for further hearings. Committee member Les Guerra, an Anchorage Democrat, says the fund is a bad approach to budgeting.
The benefit of getting an amount of money for transportation that we would likely appropriate anyway, compared to the burden, which is a faster depletion of what might remain of our $17 billion in savings, I think weighs in favor of protecting our savings and then funding transportation on an annual basis.
At an earlier hearing, Wilson said she only expects to get the constitutional amendment through the legislature this session. To do that, she will have to get it passed by the full House and through the Senate.
We understand that this is probably not the year to ask for $2 billion. Even in a year with abundant revenue, this would be difficult. This endowment could be a lesser sum with the idea of adding to the endowment when our savings accounts are more flush.
The measure needs to go before the voters because Alaska's constitution prohibits dedicated funds. That's all for Raven News for this morning. It's 8 a.m. This is KCAW Sitka. We're going to rejoin NPR's Morning Edition, and then I'll be back with you at 8:18 with a live local interview. Do stay tuned for that if you can. Have a wonderful morning.